Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 55, Toleration in the West. Last time, we saw how Galerius and his nephew Maximinus Dion brutally continued the great persecution. This episode, we return to the West, where exactly the opposite happened, as Christianity soon regained legal toleration. However, in spite of this, peace within the churches will remain elusive. In addition to the events within the early church, though, we also need to cover a heavy amount of Roman imperial history in this episode, in order to understand both the wider historical context and lay the groundwork for future episodes. Previously, we saw Diocletian and Maximian jointly abdicate, and Constantius and Galerius succeed them as Augusti. The new Caesars were each partisans of Galerius, his nephew Maximinus Dia, and his officer Severus, the latter of whom took up Maximian's place in the imperial court of Milan. The two men who had likely originally been intended to become Caesars were the sons of the first pair of Western emperors, Constantine and Maxentius. It was the passing over of these two princes which sowed the seeds of collapse for the Second Tetrarchy. The beginning of the end of the Tetrarchy will set off a series of political maneuverings and civil wars which will eventually lead to the Roman Empire once again being ruled by a single man. Therefore, it is high time that we finally, properly introduce this man, since he is going to dominate so much of our narrative in the coming episodes. The man who, after Christ himself and the Apostle Paul, is arguably the next most influential person in the history of the early church. I'm talking, of course, about Flavius Valerius Aurelius Constantinus, better known to us as Constantine the Great, the first Christian Roman emperor. Constantine was born in the Moesian city of Nisus on February 27th, most likely in the year 273 AD. His father Constantius was at the time a soldier in the army of the emperor Aurelian. The status of his mother Flavia Julia Helena, yes, that Helena, is less certain, and the exact legal nature of her relationship with Constantius is somewhat disputed. However, one theory posits that Helena was a stable girl and daughter of an innkeeper at an imperial post station in Bithynia. Shortly before Constantius was made Caesar, 20 years later, he ended his relationship to Helena to wed Theodora, the daughter of the Western Augustus Maximian. The marriage was extremely fruitful, as Theodora bore Constantius 6 children, 3 sons and 3 daughters. Constantine was, however, always his father's firstborn son and heir, being around 20 years older than his half-siblings. When his father transitioned from just being Maximian's Praetorian Prefect to being his son-in-law and then Caesar, Constantine's own prospects were dramatically raised. Shortly thereafter, young Constantine was sent to the east, where he served under Galerius as a high-ranking military tribune. There he also seems to have become cultivated, to varying degrees, in the language and thought of the Greek East. It was also around this time that Constantine married his first wife, Minervina, who historian Timothy Barnes has suggested may have been related to Diocletian. The couple produced a son, born in the late 3rd century, named Flavius Julius Crispus. Constantine participated in Galerius's campaign against the Persians, and after Galerius sacked Ctesiphon, Constantine took the opportunity to view the ruins of ancient Babylon. Afterwards, he was present at Antioch for the failed divinations, which launched the persecution of the army. Constantine remained with Diocletian's court, traveling to Alexandria and back between 301 and 302. While in Egypt, Constantine also took the time to visit the local sites, including a visit to the ruins of ancient Memphis. Either when the imperial court was going down to Alexandria or returning north to Antioch, Eusebius of Caesarea saw Constantine as Diocletian's entourage passed through Palestine. Eusebius recounts how Constantine was seated in a place of honor next to the senior emperor, demonstrating to all that he was being groomed for the purple. Constantine returned with Diocletian to Nicomedia and was present in the city during the final deliberations concerning the Christian question. He later recalled how the oracle of Apollo's response was received at Nicomedia, spurning Diocletian to issue his first edict of persecution. It also appears that during his stay in Nicomedia he met Lactantius, and the two men became acquaintances. Constantine may even have been the source for much of Lactantius's information about what was going on behind closed doors in the imperial palace. When the persecution began, Constantine was on the scene to witness the implementation of a policy both he and his father strongly disapproved of. Historian David Potter infers that Constantine regretted his failure to take action against Diocletian's anti-Christian policies. With a little pop psychology, Potter suggests Constantine was not proud of the man he was in 303 when the persecution began, and that this motivated him in the years following. Constantine also witnessed the fire in the palace, which unleashed Diocletian's persecution of the imperial household. He later remarked that the fire was actually caused by a bolt of lightning. Constantine appears to have left Nicomedia with Galerius in mid-March and participated in his campaigns along the Danube. Later sources recount tales of how Galerius tried to get Constantine killed during these battles with the barbarians, playing King Saul to Constantine's young David. It's highly doubtful these stories are true and probably reflect later propaganda. It appears Constantine accompanied Diocletian to Rome in 303 and back to Nicomedia in 304. He was present at the ceremony outside Nicomedia in May of 305 when Diocletian appointed the new Caesars, before abdicating from the Imperial College. Such is where we left him last episode. Constantine did not remain in Nicomedia for very long after being passed over. He eventually managed to join his father in the West, who had been imploring Galerius to release his son to him. Constantine's propaganda later put out a colorful fiction of how this transpired. The story goes that in a drunken state, Galerius consented to letting Constantine leave in the morning. But Constantine left that very night, traveling via the imperial post and killing all the horses at each inn so Galerius's agents couldn't pursue him. Finally, Constantine reached his dying father's side in Britain. In reality, though Constantine did manage to escape Galerius's clutches, he reached his father while Constantius was still in Gaul. Father and son then crossed the English Channel together to campaign against the Picts in Scotland. The following spring, Constantius and his army had settled in Ibaricum, modern-day York. The Western Augustus was already ailing, and by that summer was on his deathbed. As one of his final acts, Constantius exercised his right as senior Augustus to appoint his son to the Imperial College, as a full Augustus, by recommending Constantine to his army. When Constantius died on July 25, 306, the army in his presence, both the legions and the allied Alemanni under their king Crocus, dutifully hailed Constantine as their new emperor. Such is what Constantine claimed, anyway. Some historians reject this and argue Constantine actually usurped the throne. But it's hard to believe that Constantius or even Galerius would not have been aware of what would happen if the former died with his son by his side in the presence of the army. An army Constantine had just commanded alongside his late father. Constantius may even have co-opted his son in a dying act of spite against his eastern colleague for overturning the original succession plan. Alternatively, historian Paul Stevenson suggests that perhaps the arrangement was all worked out ahead of time between Constantius and Galerius. However it happened, Constantine sent an image of himself wearing a laurel crown and a letter to Galerius announcing his appointment. If this was news to Galerius, then he was obviously infuriated, but there was nothing he could do about it. He could not gainsay Constantine's claim to have been lawfully appointed by his father. However, as the new senior Augustus, Galerius only recognized Constantine as Caesar, with Severus as the new Augustus of the West. Constantine wisely accepted his entry into the Imperial College at the lower rank. Setting up his court along the Rhine at his father's capital of Trier, Constantine now had undisputed imperial legitimacy. For the next 5 years, he set about establishing and solidifying his position from Gaul. In the intervening months before Galerius's response to Constantine's elevation was relayed back to the West, however, Constantine made an important use of his temporary status as an Augustus. It seems that Caesars could issue rescripts and other forms of law, but only the Augusti had the authority to issue innovative legislation in the form of imperial edicts. So, what sort of edict did Constantine issue during this earliest period of his reign? He officially declared toleration for Christianity. Furthermore, he likely also ordered the restoration of church property, which had been confiscated during the Great Persecution, though this may have been done at a slightly later date. These actions have frequently been overlooked in light of the more famous laws Constantine would issue for Christianity later in his reign. But the fact remains that 6 years before the emperor is said to have converted, he had already issued legislation in favor of his Christian subjects. Constantine's motivations were probably as follows. Issuing the edict allowed him to gain the support of the Christian minority in his domains, it advertised his status as an Augustus, and it allowed him to distance himself from the persecuting regime of the First Tetrarchy. Now, as his father had not really participated in the persecution, the only Christians who really benefited from this policy were the scattered few who had lost their church buildings in Gaul and Britain, and the Christians of Spain, who had suffered under Maximian. Christians in Constantine's territory now enjoyed full legal freedom of worship, and it wasn't long before another regime change brought about a similar toleration for the churches of Italy and Africa. Ironically, it was Galerius's desire to assert himself as senior emperor in the West, which inadvertently caused this chain of events to unfold. As we discussed last episode, the new Eastern Augustus implemented a stringent census policy in 306, which required even non-land-owning city dwellers to be registered. This census was also carried out in the West, and was extended to areas which, for centuries, had enjoyed tax-exempt privileges. While Diocletian had extended normal taxation to northern Italy, he had stopped there. Galerius now extended the system to all of Italy south of the Po Valley, including the city of Rome, places which had been exempt from taxation for centuries. You'll remember that the citizens of the old capital had parted with Diocletian on bad terms back in 303, and they appear to have been none too keen on his successor. The old Roman Senate also had been marginalized ever since Diocletian came to power. When Galerius's tax officials arrived in the city in the autumn of 306, the Romans staged a revolt. This revolt centered around the other man passed over for succession, the son of Maximian, Marcus Aurelius Valerius Maxentius. Born sometime in the 280s, Maxentius was the son of Maximian and his wife Eutropia, and thus brother to Theodora and brother-in-law to Constantius. He had also married Galerius's daughter Valeria Maximilla. After he was passed over for Severus, Maxentius took up residence near Rome. Maxentius was certainly infuriated over being cut out of the succession, and Constantine's recent ascension instilled a jealous envy, especially once Constantine's official portraits were placed in the city. In addition to the local citizens and magistrates, Maxentius also found support with the Praetorian Guard. Galerius had recently demolished their camp outside the city, and reduced their numbers by incorporating many of the Guard's members into his own army. After gaining the support of the urban cohorts and killing their commander, who had remained loyal to the Tetrarchy, the remnants of the Praetorian Guard joined Maxentius and the people, and on October 28, 306, proclaimed Maxentius emperor. At first, Maxentius took the title Princeps, modeling his rule on the old pre-Diocletian imperial style. He hoped his father-in-law would take less offense to this title and recognize him, as he had Constantine. But Galerius hated Maxentius, and the very idea of the Tetrarchy meant there could only be 4 legitimate emperors, not 5. Civil war was now inevitable. Seeing that he was not going to receive recognition, Maxentius eventually assumed the title of Augustus. The coup of Maxentius set off the civil wars of the Tetrarchy. Galerius ordered Severus to defeat the usurper and restore Italy and Africa to the legitimate imperial college. Maxentius, for his part, shored up his position and invited his father Maximian to join him and become Augustus for a second time. Maximian, who had never wanted to abdicate in the first place, jumped at the chance to rule again, this time with his son. In the spring of 307, Severus marched south to Rome to put down the rebellion. However, the army under Severus's command was the army which had loyally served Maximian for decades. Outside the city, Severus's troops began deserting in droves to their former commander, and Severus was forced to flee to Ravenna. Maximian pursued him and managed to coax him out of the city after assuring Severus of his safety. Severus then returned the same imperial robe to Maximian he had received from him nearly 2 years earlier. Maximian then imprisoned Severus in Rome. After all this had elapsed, Maxentius and Maximian began to prepare in earnest for Galerius's inevitable counterattack. In September of 307, Maximian made a journey north to Constantine in Trier. There, an alliance was formed and cemented via the traditional Roman means, marriage. Just as his father had wed Maximian's elder daughter Theodora, now Constantine married the younger daughter, Flavia Maxima Fausta. Constantine's first wife, Minervina, had either died or he put her aside in the interest of a political marriage. At this same ceremony, Maximian also formally invested Constantine with the rank of Augustus, and from that point on, Constantine presented himself as such. When word reached Galerius of what had happened, he ceased to recognize Constantine as an official emperor and turned his attention to defeating Maxentius. While Maximian was up in Gaul, Galerius invaded Italy with his army and made his way to Rome. In response, Maxentius decided to put Severus to death, probably on September 15, 307. In addition, Maxentius made sure the Eternal City was well defended and manned the imposing Aurelian walls. Galerius had never actually seen the symbolic capital of his empire, and quickly realized he did not have the numbers to besiege it. Soon, elements within Galerius's own army began to desert, in part through Maxentius's use of bribes and propaganda. Not wanting to suffer the same fate as Severus, Galerius threw himself at the feet of his soldiers, begging them to remain loyal, and promising that in return, they could pillage and plunder all of northern Italy on the way back to Illyricum. The soldiers accepted, and the Eastern Augustus made his way back to Sirtica, with his army devastating the home province of the empire in the process. Having now introduced the civil wars of the Tetrarchy, we can turn our attention back to events pertaining directly to the early church. In late 306, not long after he came to power, Maxentius issued an edict of toleration for Christianity within his domains of Italy and Africa. Though active persecution had already ceased, Maxentius's decree finally brought an official peace to the Christians now under his rule. Unlike Constantine, though, Maxentius did not at this stage issue a law ordering the restitution of the property, which had been confiscated under his father Maximian. As had been the case with the persecution of Decius over half a century earlier, the churches of Rome and Africa did not emerge unified or stronger following the peace. No, they instead devolved into the internecine strife between competing factions. In this episode, we'll confine ourselves to events in Rome. I want to save Africa and the story of the Donatist Schism for a future episode. The origins of the schism between Catholics and Donatists is a complex one, plagued with numerous uncertainties over dating and evidence. Rather than splicing it into this episode, I think the narrative will be more comprehensible in an episode devoted exclusively to the beginning of the Donatist Schism. So, for those of you who are looking forward to that story, you'll need to wait a little longer, but I do believe it will be well worth it. For this episode, just know that while the Roman Christians are fighting among themselves, the African Christians are also fighting among themselves, with even worse results. The Church of Rome had been in a state of chaos since Pope Marcellinus had compromised during the Great Persecution. The events which occurred afterwards are unclear, but following Marcellinus's death, the Christians of Rome declined to consecrate a new bishop until Maxentius issued official toleration. In the intervening years, the Roman Church quickly broke down over the same familiar fault lines of rigorous and laxus. In November or December of 306, a new pope was finally elected, and it was the rigorous faction who won out. Their man was the presbyter Marcellus, who was uncompromising in his attitude towards the lapsed. He tried to have Marcellinus's name stricken from the official list of bishops, and issued harsh penances to repentant Christians under his authority. Things became so bad between the rigorous and moderates that riots and bloody street fighting between Christians occurred in the city. As the early church had grown in numbers, its members had begun to take on the less savory characteristics of the urban populations of the empire, namely, the proclivity for factional popular violence. An unfortunate trend we will continue to see more of throughout the century. The conflict eventually worsened to the point that Maxentius actually took action. After being denounced by an apostate to the emperor, Marcellus was banished from the city and died in exile on January 19, 308. Furthermore, Maxentius appears to have prevented the election of a successor for a number of months, a decision possibly influenced by his father. A new bishop wasn't consecrated until April 18th, probably in 308, though the year is not completely certain. Political events, however, soon caused Maxentius to briefly seek the support of his Christian subjects. After Maximian returned to Rome from Gaul, he discovered his own prestige had diminished in favor of his son. It had been Maxentius, not the elder Maximian, who had repelled Galerius and defended the Senate and people of Rome. Maximian's jealousy only grew, and on April 20th, 308, he summoned an informal meeting of the soldiers and people. Atop the tribunal, he launched into a tirade on the ills of the state, and then, to the shock of everyone, pointed at his son as the cause, before proceeding to tear the purple robe from Maxentius's shoulders. Maxentius leapt from the platform and was caught by the crowd. The assembly quickly turned against Maximian, who realized to his own horror that he was not the beloved figure in Rome he had thought he was. It was to Maxentius that the city was currently loyal to. Maximian quickly fled Rome and made for the court of his son-in-law in Gaul, where Constantine received him. This, in turn, brought a practical end to the alliance between Constantine and Maxentius. Needing to consolidate his power base again, Maxentius once again presented himself as a tolerant friend of the Christian community. such a disposition was not to last. The Church of Rome was still torn between the rigorous and moderates. This time, the moderates succeeded in getting their man elected pope, the presbyter Eusebius. Eusebius championed a laxer policy, which favored readmitting the lapsed. The rigorous, in response, consecrated their own bishop, Heraclius, and violence once again erupted between the rival camps. Maxentius exiled both papal claimants, and Eusebius died in exile on October 21st. The emperor did not permit another bishop to be elected until 311, by which time his regime was beginning to crumble. We'll close out this episode by syncing back up with where we left things off last episode, when in the autumn of 308, the Christians of the East experienced a second respite. With the murder of his comrade Severus and his failure to defeat Maxentius, Galerius needed to reconstitute the Second Tetrarchy and re-cement his authority as the senior emperor. On November 11, 308, Galerius held an imperial summit in a military camp by the Pannonian city of Carnuntum on the Danube River. The summit was attended by both Maximian and none other than Diocletian himself. You'll remember that the retired emperor had been living out his twilight years in his fortress palace of Spoletum on the Dalmatian coast. The reason for Diocletian's presence at the summit depends on who you ask. The most popular version has it that Galerius implored his former master to rescue the empire and even don the purple once again. Diocletian is said to have refused, having become utterly content with retired life, even remarking how splendid the cabbages were which he had grown. A more cynical take is that Diocletian's presence was merely a publicity move used by Galerius to bolster the legitimacy of his own position, as well as to persuade Maximian to renounce imperial rule once again. The two versions are not entirely incompatible, and however it happened, the results of the Conference of Carnuntum were certainly to Galerius's favor. Maximian was once again compelled to abdicate. He and Diocletian were instead given the symbolic title of Signores Augusti. Galerius re-recognized Constantine as a legitimate Caesar, while a new Augustus of the West was appointed to deal with Maxentius. This man was a fellow Balkan-born officer and longtime comrade of Galerius's named Gaius Valerius Licinianus Licinius. With the prestige of the great Diocletian behind it, Galerius's new tetrarchy would consist of himself and his Caesar Maximinus Dia in the east, and Licinius and his Caesar Constantine in the west. Licinius would defeat Maxentius and restore Italy and Africa to the lawful imperial college. Such was the plan, anyway. Over in Trier, Constantine took no notice of any of this and continued to style himself as Augustus. Maximian's second abdication was, like the first, extremely reluctant. The invented title given to him in Diocletian meant effectively nothing in terms of power and authority. After the conference, the former Augustus of the West made his way back to the court of Constantine in Gaul. However, in less than 2 years, Maximian will betray his son-in-law as he did his son, and claim the throne once again. Only this time, Maximian will finally meet his end, becoming the first of the four persecuting emperors to die. But that is for another day. Galerius, for his part, faced insubordination from his nephew in the east. Maximinus was outraged that his uncle had co-opted Licinius into the imperial college as a full Augustus, whereas he was still just a Caesar. Galerius tried to pacify the situation by inventing the title Sons of the Augusti for Constantine and Maximinus, but it did no good. By 309, Maximinus informed his uncle that his legions had acclaimed him Augustus. Galerius was at long last forced to recognize both his nephew and Constantine as full Augusti. Thus, in 309, there were four Augusti in the legitimate imperial college. Meanwhile, Licinius tried to finally crush Maxentius, but, like Severus and Galerius before him, he too failed, and Italy and Africa continued to remain outside the control of the Tetrarchy. Such were the events at the imperial level, which gave the Christians of the East a second respite from the Great Persecution, all the way until the autumn of 309. Next episode, we head back to the East, where the conflict between Pope Peter of Alexandria and Meletius of Lycopolis will finally reach the breaking point. Not only that, but theological controversy will spring up over the great scholar Origen of Alexandria, prompting Pamphilus and Eusebius to write in his defense. Soon after, though, Galerius will renew the Great Persecution in what will prove to be his last attempt to stamp out the Christian faith.